right, we're back. I'm Thomas Drance. This is Canucks Talk. I called it Canucks Hour. I also said Besser hit 40 points. He hit 40 goals. So I'm a little bit out of sorts, but that's okay. We're having fun. Last thing I got wrong, my final errors and omissions from segment one, is Shayna will be at 1 p.m. Okay, Shayna will be at 1, and then we've got Kevin Woodley at 1:30, which means this is the open segment. So if you want to get in any questions, if you want to discuss anything, let me know. I do want to note, by the way, because I didn't in the whiteboard and probably should have, officially, McDavid has a lower body injury and is day-to-day, reports Mark Spector. He's questionable for tomorrow in Vegas. The injury happened with roughly 5 minutes to play in Calgary on Saturday, Spector reports. Sounds like an injury, but not a major one. With the playoffs around the corner, the Oilers will be careful. So that's a little bit of a break, too. Something to keep in mind when pricing out the Oilers plus 250 to win the Pacific Division and considering Dom Lecision's playoff odds, which when they were posted would not have factored in a possible McDavid absence into the model. Okay. Canucks Talk, of course, just want to remind you, is brought to you by Kintec, which is why I'm coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec is Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet? What are you waiting for? Also use the 650-650 Dunbar Lumber text line to text into the show. We can do a mailbag if you want to engage with me. That would be great. Could definitely use your help. And of course, Dunbar Lumber has three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center. You can also find them on Arbutus in Vancouver or visit them online at dunbarlumber.com. All right, we got a first question in and I'm curious to handle it. Like I want to discuss this because I think it's interesting and I think sort of dovetails with wider discussions about optimal lines and how the Canucks should approach things in the playoffs. Amro the actor asks, when can we see Joshua on the top line and is it too late to try him there? I'm not sure if he means the first power play unit, because if you're playing with JT Miller, you're basically on the top line. Like that's usually Vancouver's first line, both in terms of ice time and often, although it kind of rotates somewhat haphazardly, who takes line rushes first, both at practice and during the warm-up skate. Last night, for example, among all Canucks forwards, Dakota Joshua was, you know, second line deployment, played 13:54 at 5-on-5. Only Miller, Garland, Pettersson, and Besser played more frequently over the course of the game. Canucks outshot the Golden Knights 9-5 in those minutes, by the way, and scored a goal. So a pretty solid performance, and that's been the case for Joshua, really, since he returned to the lineup, right? I mean, Joshua's been playing big-time minutes and been performing very well while getting a pretty extended look here with skilled players, like with some of Vancouver's best players. In the six games since he returned, you know, Joshua's got 3 goals and an assist, so 4 points in 6 games, and he's been over 15 minutes in 4 of the 6 games, with another one being a 14-minute 56. So essentially, he's playing 15 minutes a night. That's top line deployment, or very close. It's you know, third or fourth highest minutes on the team sort of deployment for forwards ever since he got back into the lineup. I've mentioned Joshua's minutes before in the context of his status as a pending unrestricted free agent. And it really looms large for me for a couple of reasons. Okay, the first one is you'll recall that Joshua sort of found himself in the doghouse at training camp, right? It wasn't the fight with Connor Garland. It was that, you know, he came in after a summer in which Rick Tocchet felt he hadn't done enough to be prepared, to be in shape. And Tocchet said so publicly. Tocchet called him out publicly. Joshua didn't pout, right? Joshua went about going to the gym, working with Canucks training staff and making sure to put those concerns to bed, something he's done in a significant way. Now, given that history and given the fact that Joshua's positioned himself to earn a major pay raise with term this summer, you know, you can understand, because this is something hockey teams worry about a lot. Like, if we give this guy term, do we mess with the motivation factor, right? Do we risk sort of not getting contract year Dakota Joshua, especially given that contract year Dakota Joshua showed up to camp in you know, a level of shape that the coach felt the need to publicly call him out for. And here's the thing about the minutes that Joshua's logging right now. He didn't play a game between February 13th and March 28th. That's a six-week stretch, right? So for 6 weeks, Joshua was on ice effectively, nursing the injury stemming from the fight that he had in Chicago. And during that stretch, Joshua worked like crazy, okay? He had lengthy on-ice sessions with Canucks skills coach Yogi Shevkovsky. He put in the work in the gym. And the fact that he's been able to jump right back into the lineup and log this sort of ice time and do so this effectively, I know for a fact that it's caught the attention of Canucks management. They're exceedingly pleased with that work ethic that he showed, with that maturity that he showed. And I think that goes a long way toward making the Canucks, or frankly, should go a long way toward making any other team willing to invest in term for this player. I think there's been a real sense of maturity around him, and I think he's proven it, which is why the minutes that he's logging over the last, you know, six games since returning from that injury matters so much. The other part of it is that, you know, I think Joshua is a really good bet to provide you with $3-3.5 million worth of value if he's a third line player. But the goal isn't to match a player's pay or their cap hit to their level of contribution and just be like, hey, he's worth it. That's fine. But if you're trying to win a Stanley Cup, if you're trying to stretch out this window, if you're trying to sustain this season's success over multiple years, you don't need value. You need surplus value. You need wins, right? And the only way I think you can win on Joshua's next contract, the only way that bet is, you know, that bet can be a single. In fact, I think that bet's likely to be a single, given Joshua's, you know, abilities on the penalty kill, his unique value as a physical player, the work rate, the goal scoring touch, especially in deep, the chemistry that he's found with Connor Garland, right? Like all of those, you sign Joshua for 4 years, $3.5 million. I'm going to say, hey, that's a single. That has a chance to be a single. In fact, a good probability. The fat part of the bell curve, to bring up an old term, is that will work. But if you're going to get surplus value, I think it's going to require Joshua playing a larger role on this team. Now, we've seen him do it. We've seen him cement himself as one of this team's best penalty killers. I'd go so far as to say he's the penalty killer I want on the ice most, frankly, at this point, among forwards. The Canucks surrender the fewest goals against with him on the ice 4-on-5. You can see it when you watch, you know, his length, his willingness to dive to disrupt plays. He had a great penalty killing sequence against the Kings, actually, you know, diving to make a play and clear the zone. He was big on that third period kill that the Canucks had last night. We've seen him already sort of expand his role, and now we're seeing him expand it further as he gets a long look down the stretch in the top six. Power play net front remains a area to watch too, right? If Josh was able to at some point work his way onto PP1, then you can see a scoring spike that'll help potentially net surplus value in the event that the Canucks are able to come to terms with this player, something the organization would like to do, something the player would prefer as well. And so the ice time thing looms large for me for a variety of reasons. It's something that should make the team more comfortable going along with him, and it's also the clearest route to turning paying. Like, you're effectively buying high on a player like this if you're signing him to his next contract. And I'm okay with it, especially because there is still room to win on this deal, provided that his role continues to expand, something that he's making a really strong case for at the moment, including last night. Alan from Mission asks when we will know whether the Canucks play on April 20th or April 21st. You know, it's going to take a bit. Like, it's going to take the playoff picture to be effectively set or very close to it before that's announced. You know, starting on the 20th given that the Vancouver Canucks finish the season late, so much later than some of their prospective first-round opponents. I mean, the Canucks play the Winnipeg Jets on Thursday, April 18th, right? And the Nashville Predators have their final game on Monday, April 15th. You know, I'm pretty confident that the Canadian broadcaster would prefer to have the Canucks play on Saturday night, but is it really fair for this team that, you know, should they win the division, like you win the division and then you face a team that's had 5 days off or 4 days between games and you've had one day off between the end of your regular season and the start of the playoffs? That seems wild to me.
But would there be a chance maybe that the NHL would want a Toronto and Vancouver Saturday night, first day of the playoffs, to just rev the engines a little bit?
I would think so, especially because, you know, if you're airing the Sunday night game, right, and the Canadian broadcaster wants Edmonton and Vancouver to be on alternating nights, right, for the late games, you know, McDavid's a draw on Sunday in a way that the Canucks aren't, despite their bevy of American stars. Maybe that changes with a deep playoff run, right? I mean, the Canucks have a chance to become the Sally Field, oh, you like me, you really like me, if they can, you know, capture the hearts and minds of hockey fans south of the 49th parallel with their roster of American players come playoff time. But it hasn't happened yet. I mean, McDavid's name rings out, even for casual sports fans, in a way, obviously, Canucks players haven't hit that level yet. So, you know, we'll see exactly how the cookie crumbles there, but I think it would be a pretty significant disadvantage if the Canucks ended up playing on the 20th, especially if they face their most probable current first-round matchup, the Nashville Predators. Just want to quickly note here, you know what would solve this? If you went 1-8 and had a play-in, you could create a path to ensure that the division winners face teams that have played either 83 or 84 games as opposed to just 82. You could ensure a rest advantage. You could ensure a significant advantage for the teams that win the division. You know, among the many problems that the NHL's current playoff format has, confusing to casual fans, pretty much arbitrary in terms of rewarding teams at the top, very, very little drama unless you get an absolute turtle derby the way we're seeing in the Eastern Conference. You know, there's nothing good about the NHL's current schedule or current playoff format in my mind. Go 1-8, include a play-in, go NBA style. And you'd change that dynamic massively. Vancouver would instead be, you know, resting while the, you know, seventh and eighth place wildcard teams play for the right to face them in the first round. Vancouver would be guaranteed to be the more rested team if the NHL had a more rational, more business-minded two playoff format. Here's a question. Should JT Miller be considered for a Selke now? Never would have considered it until last night. I think Canucks fans have considered it. I'd expect he'll get some votes, especially given the defensive performance of this team overall. And, you know, his faceoff percentage, right? Faceoff percentage is like the bushy tail on a squirrel for defensive forwards, right? I mean, a squirrel is effectively a rodent, except they've got better PR because they've got this big bushy tail that everyone thinks is cute. Defensive forwards are kind of similar, right? You can be a great defensive forward, but if you're winning 48% of your faceoffs and another guy's winning 56%, well, when PHWA voters make their way to the NHL.com stats page and try to find out who they're going to vote for the Selke, they're going to prefer the forward with the bushy tail. So I think Miller will be considered. You know, my view of it, and I still have to dig in a little bit on the Selke, assuming that I get a ballot. The thing that's sort of notable, I think, about Vancouver's defensive performance this season is, you know, I don't know that it's being driven principally by the defensive contributions of any specific forward on the team. I mean, one thing that's sort of interesting is if you check like team relative defensive stats, stuff that like Evolving Hockey does at length with their RAPM metrics and a variety of other things. Neither Pettersson or Miller, both of whom I think have had excellent two-way seasons, appear to be defensive drivers this season. And that's partly because Vancouver's profile as a team isn't contingent on who is on the ice. Like, this team plays well defensively almost regardless. So, you know, for example, the Canucks are surrendering 27.5 shots against per 60 with Miller on the ice. The number is 26.1 with Pettersson on the ice. It's 25.7 with Bluger on the ice. It's 24.8 with Pugh Suter on the ice. So effectively, this is a high-end defensive team regardless of which line is playing. Given that dynamic, which differs from what you'll see from some of the other top Selke contenders, I think that's tricky. Like, it's tricky for me to credit Miller. I'll credit Miller as having an excellent two-way season, but do I credit him? How much do I credit him for this team's team-level defensive excellence, which we've seen, you know, sort of persist throughout the season? You know, and just to give you an example, like, the Florida Panthers surrender 31 shots against per hour with Sam Bennett on the ice, 25 shots per hour with Anton Lundell on the ice, 24 shots per hour with Sasha Barkov. You see that split, right? Like, they're literally surrendering almost 8 additional shots per 60 minutes with Sam Bennett 5-on-5, and all of that goes away once it's Barkov. Like, that to me looms very large here. And sort of works a little bit against Miller. It just, in terms of how I think about it anyway, we'll see what voters think. I think Miller will be considered. I think he'll get some votes. I do think he's going to be in tough on my ballot, just given how I work to try and parcel out individual from team success in voting for that particular award. JP from Montreal asks, who would be the interesting call-ups for the playoffs that the Canucks could bring from Abbotsford? Now, the Canucks won't, like, immediately enter the playoffs and call up Black Aces, given that the Abbotsford Canucks have already clinched a playoff berth, their second consecutive playoff berth under Jeremy Colliton. And congratulations to our pals in the Valley. Going to be some interesting games there, even though Jonathan Lekkarimäki is unlikely to be part of it, given that he's made Team Sweden and will surely represent the Tre Kronor at the World Championships in May. Until Abbotsford loses, the Canucks won't bring up Black Aces. Who are there real contributors in Abbotsford that we could see factor in to Vancouver's lineup at the NHL level for the playoffs? I mean, I think if we see that things have gone badly, like, I don't think it's something that we're hoping to see at this point. You know, if I was sort of to tier the Abbotsford players most likely to factor in for the Canucks in the postseason, yeah, you know, I suppose Arshdeep Bains would kind of go as a top line consideration. Maybe Artur Seelovs, especially with how he's played in three starts for the Canucks so far. Sort of in a tier down, I think you could put, like, Sheldon Dries, defenseman Matt Irwin, a veteran defenseman, who we could absolutely see in the event that the Canucks have, you know, a Nolan Baumgartner type situation on a deep playoff run. Christian Wolanin. You know, we saw what he could do down the stretch last season, had a bit of a tough training camp, probably cost him a chance to play at the NHL level over the course of this year. But not to mention that he's spent a large stretch of this season hurt. But yeah, Wolanin to me and Matt Irwin, Sheldon Dries, those are the sort of guys with experience that we could see. And then Arshdeep Bains and Artur Seelovs as well. One thing to note, the way this organization thinks about developing players, I think they're going to be pretty reluctant overall to throw younger guys into supporting depth roles come playoff time. You don't want a guy who's playing like 5 minutes, right? First of all, that's like a learned skill, right? Hockey players, guys like Baines, they're used to being big parts of their team, right? His routine is to play, and even when we saw him at the NHL level, he's getting 10 minutes a night. Well, guess what happens in the playoffs? The depth guys, your 12th forward, he might play 3 minutes. He might play 4 minutes. And what do you need? You need a guy who's done it before, in my view, who's focused, who's able to give you 4 minutes of, like, high intensity, safe hockey without getting in their head about it, right? Without sort of having to learn how to do it. That's something that I think is important. And I think it's something that the organization thinks is important, something the organization will consider strongly in filling out their NHL lineup card, their playoff lineup card. Question. When is the last time Garland was asked about his early season trade request? Has it been withdrawn? Where does it stand? Garland has discussed this at length. If you go to The Athletic, you can read a column I wrote following the club's win in Montreal in November, You know, I don't quote Garland in it directly, but there's a fair bit of intel that's stemming from conversations we had on background. And, you know, the genesis of it is there was a situation where the team and the player were both open to moving on, and Garland changed agents, and there was some effort mutually to see if there was a solution that could move Garland out and clear up some cap space for the Canucks. Ultimately, the Canucks end up, you know, trading Tanner Pearson and finding different ways to carve out cap space and make it all work. Garland remains. The team gets hot. Everyone's having fun. Garland's having the most fun he's ever had in his career. And guess what happens when people win? Nothing changes, right? Teams like to win, and they like to keep winning teams together to give them the opportunity to see how far they can push their luck. And the Canucks have pushed their luck to the verge of the third most successful regular season in franchise history. We all know how this story has gone. Garland was actually annoyed by the reports that he'd rescinded his trade request, not because they were accurate, but because he felt like a trade request had never been tendered in the first place. So, you know, that's sort of the story there. It's one of those where the information was good, but it was maybe framed in a slightly overzealous way. And that's something to keep in mind when you sort of try to read between the lines, right? When you try to read between the lines of the sort of reports that get out there in hockey media circles. Here's an interesting one, big picture one, unsigned. Is it more prudent for the Canucks to give in on term to minimize annual average value, or to maintain flexibility by limiting term and paying higher AAV specifically for role players like Joshua and Bluger? Now, this one is really interesting to me, because I think the way you have to think about this is you have to make a bet on where the upper limit of the salary cap is likely to go to. And this is not straightforward. Okay, we know that the cap's going to end up somewhere in the realm of 87.5 million this summer. What's unknown is where it goes beyond that, right? Based on what the NHL is saying about where their levels of revenue are, and based on the lag formula as spelled out in the MOU, that sort of that omnibus agreement that returned the NHL to play on the other side of the pandemic and also extended the CBA through 2025-26. Like, I sort of put that together and talked to people who know what they're doing around the league, and, you know, people are eyeing, like, wild numbers, numbers in the mid to high $90 million range for the upper limit of the cap come the offseason of 2025. Well, that to me is wildly interesting. I mean, if we're going to see that level of YOY cap growth beyond next season, you know, to me, that's an argument to make bets that are locking in lower AAVs in general, because the percentage of the cap that those deals might take up, you know, it is infinitesimal relative to what they've been for the past 5 years, this sort of long, turgid phase of zero cap growth that the league has kind of soldiered through. So, you know, I think that's the dynamic you have to weigh there. In Bluger's case, you know, he's 29, so, but doesn't really take a lot of hits, doesn't, I mean, I'm not trying to say that he's not a hard player. I love the workmanlike way that he plays. But, you know, some of the things he does well, intelligence, winning draws, that's stuff that tends to age better. So that's an interesting one to me. I mean, can you more easily stomach like a David Kampf comparable type contract given projected cap growth? I'd say yes. And yet, you know, one thing this organization's done really well, right? One thing this hockey operations group has especially excelled at is finding quality glue guys on no-risk deals, right? Why lock in players of that ilk given your demonstrated ability to replace them, right? Like, doesn't that sort of limit you? And then Joshua's sort of a different question entirely, because, you know, I like the short-term bet on Joshua to provide value even up to $3.5 million, maybe even more, $1 million a year. Where I get a little nervous is, even though his NHL track record's somewhat limited, he doesn't have a ton of tread on those tires, players that hit a lot and get hit a lot, and Joshua's always in the middle of it, which is to his credit, you know, they can age a little bit differently than, you know, guys like Quinn Hughes, who are never hit, like who I rarely see take a hit unless it's, you know, late, thanks Trevor Moore. So, you know, that one is additionally complicated to sort of handicap because I think you're taking on more risk going long in some ways than you are paying him more shorter term. And yet, you know, if he's able to maintain his level for 4 years and you're able to lop 500K off that cap hit, I mean, that's meaningful. That's an extra player or two. So how the team assesses and weighs cap growth, the value of certainty versus the flexibility of having cap space and potentially a wash of cap space with significant cap growth upcoming, you know, that's fascinating to me. And then sort of throwing an additional wrench into it is one of their greatest strengths has been finding glue guys, undervalued glue guys for reasonable, low cost, zero risk deals on short-term deals. If the cap goes up, that's more ammunition for your pro scouting department that, you know, under the watchful eye of Cammy Granato and Alvin and Rutherford, of course, has just found win after win after win for much of the past 12 months, with only a few exceptions like Kuzmenko, Beauvillier, and Lindholm's tracking that way, although I still insist that the jury is out on that particular trade until we get to the postseason. All right. We'll be back on the other side. We've got Shayna. We've got Woodley. Stay tuned. You're listening to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk. I'm your host, Thomas Drance, flying solo. Today, we've got Shayna Goldman on the phone. We'll get to her very shortly. Just want to remind you that Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. They are the absolute best, and I cannot recommend their Kubota skid steers and loaders more highly. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. Of course, I'm coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec is Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet? What are you waiting for? Tom is so mad at that. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. If you've got a question for Shayna, feel free to use it. If you've got a question for me, feel free to use it. Dunbar Lumber has three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or on Arbutus in Vancouver. Visit them online at dunbarlumber.com. All right, joining the show, my colleague at The Athletic, one of the talented hosts of the Too Many Men podcast. It's one of my favorites, Shayna Goldman. Shayna, how are you?
I'm good. What enthusiasm today. I'm loving it.
This is what happens when I fly solo. I have to keep the energy up or I flail massively. This is it. I have one speed today, Shayna, so excuse me in advance. I've crushed 3 venti coffees.
I love it. I'm here for it. Let's go.
So, Shayna, I'm going to ask you to serve as something of an advanced scout. You're our advanced scout today on Canucks Talk, and Dom's model, which we are contractually obligated to reference 3 times a segment, according to the conspiracy theorists, has the Canucks slated as having a 37% chance of facing the Nashville Predators, a 34% chance of facing the LA Kings, and a 27% chance of facing the Vegas Golden Knights in the first round. Notable, too, that the Canucks are none of those teams' most likely opponents. So, the playoff picture at the moment for Vancouver is clear as mud. How would you rank those 3 potential matchups in terms of their favorability from a Canucks perspective?
Ooh, That's a tough one. I'm torn here.
I know, like, it is tough.
If I know, these are so hard. Well, why do we do playoff matchups? I mean, come on. I'm going to have to be in the thick of this next week. I already know it.
Here, I'll help you out. Okay, so here's how I'd rank them. Okay, and then you can and then you can poke holes at my theory.
This is great.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I would rank Vegas as the least favorable, Nashville as the second least favorable, and LA as the most favorable. Even though the Kings took 7 of 8 possible points in the head-to-head series, my reasoning being that I think the upside case on Vegas, it might be the highest in the league, right? With like the possible exception of Dallas, Carolina, if they get the some bounces offensively, you know, and maybe Colorado. Nashville, to me, they just generate so many shots, so many quality looks that, you know, that profiles to me like a team where if a couple things go their way, I mean, it could be a week later and you're down 3-0 already fighting for your playoff lives. And the Kings to me just feel like a foil team. I can see them beating just about anyone in the West, but I can't see them winning the cup in a way that, you know, I honestly can see for both Vegas and Nashville if the stars align. That's my logic. What do you think?
Okay. That's what I was initially leaning towards.
Yes.
So I'm going to agree with you. I wouldn't want to play Vegas if I'm anyone. First of all, let's go with the cliche stuff, right? They know how to win. They know what it takes. And that does matter. It really does matter. And, you know, we saw them buckle down when they needed to last year. They're a great team. They're a deep team. Even if they don't have Mark Stone back, you look at that center depth and you go, Eichel, Hurdle, William Karlsson. You have two potential shutdown pairs because Hanifin has really bolstered their defensive strength, which is great because their goaltending situation is a little fuzzy right now. They're one of the few teams I think that can get by with average goaltending. So, and I like what Logan Thompson is bringing anyway. But if they don't have Aiden Hill, they're a little bit weaker there. I think they have a little bit of everything. They come at you in waves. They're a good counterattacking team. So I would be worried about them. Mm. I wouldn't want to face them. The Predators are this sneaky disruptor that I love. I've had so much fun watching them this year, yep. Especially since that turnaround. Roman Josi looks like cart candidate. It's too bad the field is stacked because he should be getting some appreciation. Phil Forsberg is playing great. Talk about a bounce back year. Ryan O'Reilly, I think, is proving he's still all that. And I think we had some questions last year, right? Like, can he still handle matchup minutes? Is he still good defensively? You know, does he need to be propped up? And sure, he has Phil Forsberg. It's not like he's doing it on his own, but he's turned back the clock. And Ryan McDonough's killing it.
He is
playing so well. And it's funny because you can still say that trade made sense for Tampa in a bunch of ways. And I get it. But he, year to year, brings just this consistency. And he's so good at this time of year. And then you have Saros, a goalie who can steal a series, just like we know Demko can.
Right.
Do you want to face them? Probably not. So then you get to the Kings. And it's not to shortchange the Kings. But you look at this team this year, and at the beginning of the year, they were such a beast, right? They played so well. They were one of the best teams playing with the lead and one of the best teams coming from behind. They had a little bit of everything. The penalty kill was great. Camp Talbot was crushing it. Since the coaching change, though, the defense is better. We all are hearing about the 1-3-1 system, and we're going to hear about it nonstop in the playoffs because we all have to cling on to a narrative, and that's going to be it. But the offense is what's giving me a little trouble with the Kings because we've seen their numbers since the coaching change tick down below the surface and on the surface level. That can bite you because I think you can contain a team for so long. But you look at some of the firepower that the Canucks have, and I think that by game 4, 5, 6, we can see it start exposing the Kings. And I think that's going to be the problem. You can contain a team if you're also, you know, creating a ton of offense. They don't do that. So to me, that's the more favorable matchup.
So my read on a possible Kings. So again, the Kings have handled the Canucks. Like, there's a sense in this market that they have the Canucks number, but they've scored first. The LA's got the first goal in all four games. And to me, that's, you know, not a secret ingredient. That's not a sign of anything except random distribution. The Canucks have been a little bit unfortunate to surrender the first goal against in all four of those games. And yet, I think both teams, their biggest limitation is their ability to generate 5-on-5. I know Vancouver has the high-end talent edge, but That edge doesn't show up in terms of this team generating chances frequently at 5-on-5, even though they're, you know, 12% plus all situations shooting percentage is hitting it for much of this year. I just feel like that's a coin flip. Like, literally, the games are all going to be decided by who scores first, and the other team's just going to pick off mistakes by the pushing team late. Like, to me, that's just the rawest possible coin flip series, and you never want that, especially should the Canucks enter the playoffs as a division winner.
I mean, so the solution is don't make the playoffs at all, and then you don't have those coin flip ones if that's the best matchup is. But no, I you know what? I agree with you. Obviously, like, we've talked about the Canucks at 5-on-5 literally all year. Is it sustainable what they're doing? Is the 5-on-5 offense enough? I like their 5-on-5 offense more than I like the Kings. Specifically since the coaching change, it's really close. But I think we're seeing a little bit more scoring chance, like creation from Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And that gives me that slight edge. Like, I like their 5-on-5 numbers over this last stretch, which is pretty encouraging when you're without your starting goalie.
Yeah.
But it's going to be close. Like, it has to be close, right? And then we're going to hear the narratives of, well, the Kings have been here before. And the Kings are going to take advantage of getting past. Yeah, and look, now they don't have Edmonton in round one. Look at what they can do. And, you know, you still have that Kopitar advantage, he's been fantastic, and Deneau, and who are they going to be matched up against? That's two shutdown centers. You can go right up against Besser's line and Pedersen's line and, you know, make the Canucks pay. But I feel like that would be – it's going to be a long series, I feel like, no matter what. I don't think Vancouver is going to have any realistic shot of a – short round one series, but I don't think anyone does in the West, honestly.
No, there's no New York Islanders, maybe Detroit. In the, I mean, okay, let me frame it to you like this.
No, I agree with you.
But
I'm with you though. It's the weak links, and even some of the contenders. Like, listen, Boston Bruins look great, but they don't dominate games consistently like you would expect a team that has their record. You know, at 5-on-5, you would expect greater gaps. Like you're seeing from the Hurricanes now, or we've seen from the Panthers much of the year. So I'm with you on that.
The Bruins are the Canucks. It's the same team.
Yeah. Yeah.
In my mind. Yeah. And, you know, both are good, but so.
Except the Canucks have all the centers.
That's true.
And the Bruins.
The Canucks have all the centers. The Bruins have David Pastrnak. With regards to the weakness of the East, would the St. Louis Blues be the seventh best team in the Eastern Conference?
Ooh. I'm not high on the Blues.
Me neither. But I still think they would
be. Yeah, they could be. I think that they have...
Sorry. I legitimately feel it's like the 5 of the 10 worst teams in this Turtle Derby out East.
You know, it's so interesting because it's like you can look at it two ways. Like, the East is so competitive. It's such a dogfight. On the other hand, like, some weeks we look at it and we're like, do any of you want to be here? Like, does anybody? And that's why, you know, like, you look at the Predators, right, and how they made that turnaround. And I like how they got rewarded by their GM, because he said it's hard to make the playoffs. And I feel like you're seeing that in the East. It's hard to make the playoffs. And it's so back and forth. Just when you think, okay, the Capitals have got this unlocked, they fall apart. You know, it's not going to be easy. And then, you know, we can get into, like, how many teams are going to be there with a negative goal differential and this, that, and everything else. Like, it's a weird year. Maybe the Blues could be, like, the seventh best team in the East. I could see that. The more I think about it, I'm like, all right, I'll bite. That's fine.
I truly am stunned by how low I am on all of these driver-class teams in the East, with the exception, maybe, of Pittsburgh.
I feel like, though, I only like the Blues because of their goaltending and like, the fact that they have some, like, scoring now. I still don't like them at 5-on-5 at all.
Yeah,
I'd be like...
I want to be clear. Me neither.
Post-coaching change, you're like, ugh, on both ends of the ice.
Yeah, the shot quality champions, I'm out on them as well. With regards to Vegas in particular, so last night, right, we see Tomáš Hertl debut. And he debuts on the wing, although I think as he gets reps, he's going to move to center. And, you know, you wouldn't expect a guy coming into his first game with a new team after a long injury layoff to be throwing his fastball, and he wasn't. But I still thought you could see the seams of something that's going to be pretty scary. In particular, late in the game, we never see this. Like, one of the first times all season I've seen this. usually the Canucks, who are one of the best faceoff teams in the league, like are really good at just killing the end of the game. And Tomáš Hertl goes in and takes like, you know, four draws against JT Miller. And I think he won all four, but he definitely won three of four, you know, in the last minute, 80 seconds of the game. And it was just like, oh my goodness, this line that right now Hurdle's on the wing, he's going to move to center. They're going to bump Stevenson out to left wing. And if Stone gets back, that's their second line. You know, they didn't have Nick Waugh last night. They didn't have Pietrangelo. They didn't have Carrier. Like, you know, they're going to have an Amadio Carrier Waugh fourth line or something in the event that all happens. Is there a chance Vegas is the true sleeping giant relative to every other team in the league?
Yeah, they totally could be. I mean, it's funny. Like, last year, I looked at Vegas going into the year. Like, this is the weakest version of the team they've put out. And even after they got Eichel, you look at the bottom six, and you're like, I'm a little underwhelmed. But they managed to make reclamation projects out. You guys like Howden and Stevenson become real contributors, and they help high-end players play to their strengths. You look at Pietrangelo and Theodore and what they're doing, and Marchessault and Barbashev. Like, it all clicks, you know? They definitely could be. It's their counterattacking style to be. They can play the matchup game better than most. And Hurdle, you look at, you know, he played in San Jose on a terrible team, where pretty much everybody was bad this year, including a lot of his line mates. And he was fantastic still. Like, he still looked just like himself, the player, the contributor you'd expect. Now surround them with some good players. Could it be Mark Stone? Like, come on. That's unbelievable if so. But even if not, and it's Chandler Stevenson who had some speed, you know, it's that liner, and Anthony Mantha, who's been really good at 5-on-5 this year. I like that. I like their chances a lot then in most matchups. I'd be curious, you know, how that team could look up against Edmonton and their speed. But I also look at it and go, but they could probably shut them down. You know, we've seen them do it before, and now they're even better than last year if they get Stone back. Totally a sleeping giant. It's going to be really interesting to see what they do. How do they follow it up with that pressure? You know, it's a different kind of pressure now that they're facing.
With the... I want to ask about awards here, and I want to ask about Quinn Hughes.
Okay.
In your view, what's the shape of the argument you'll be having internally as you fill out your Norris ballot?
Well, I'm going to be doing all the work next week because I get to do my yearly Norris story, so I'm going to get so deep in the weeds in this, it's going to be annoying. but that's
okay,
what
so
like
we won't now. Hold you to a final decision, just your preconceived notions as you begin that exercise.
I mean, I know he's at the top of the argument. He has been all year. I think it's funny. I feel like if you say anyone but him, it feels like you're a hater on Quinn Hughes, and you're not. Like, he's there, but sometimes, you know, you got to look at everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I have Roman Josi up there. Mm-hmm. I think he's been outstanding in the second half of the season. The knock against him is going to be that he plays, what, 17% of the penalty kill minutes that are available to him. But it really depends on, you know, should he be killing more penalties? Probably not.
Yeah.
Like, they use him in a certain way for a reason. It's not like he's being completely sheltered out there. But it'll be fun to like dig into those who goes up against top competition consistently numbers and look at some of the, you know, how they fare in those minutes. Because I think that is an important part of the conversation. I think someone like Evan Bouchard should get some appreciation. Mm-hmm. I think Makar's second half has been much better than he had a weird streak in the middle there. That was a bit of a tough run after he was, I think it was the favorite to go up against Hughes. You know, he's still in the conversation. I think, you know, Noah Dobson was up there for a lot of the year. I know his numbers have trailed off since the coaching change. He's like one of the few Islanders that you've seen take a small step back, but I think he's trending right back up during this little winning stretch that they have. But he's been really good too and stepped up in a way I didn't expect. So I think it's a deep race and a deep conversation this year, more than just it's Quinn Hughes, slam dunk, that's it. But you know, he's leading the way for a reason.
Are there any other Canucks players, dark horses in various categories? Like, we've had some texters chime in, especially because JT Miller just played 9 minutes head-to-head against Jack Eichel, and Vegas got two shots in those minutes last night. Will Miller be a Selke consideration for you?
I pulled the numbers a couple days ago, and I didn't have him top five.
Mm-hmm.
And it's less about him and more about guys like Barkov and Jordan Staal just killing it.
Yeah.
I'd be curious how it looks after last night. If I had to pick, though, someone on the Canucks to be in awards talk, it would be Thatcher Demko.
Mm.
I know, obviously, his season got shortened by injury, but he's, you know, he saved 25 goals above expected. You know, by evolving hockey, I think that's fourth in the league right now.
Yeah.
Hellebuck's going to win it. It's a race for second place this year, but I can't see how Demko doesn't fall top three there. I don't think someone like Markstrom's going to get as much appreciation as he should because the record and wins, even though that shouldn't be held against goalies, and also his game since the deadline. You know, Binnington could get some consideration, which wouldn't have expected, but sure, we're here. And, you know, the Bruins strike is going to be that the two goalies work against each other in that sense because they're so good. But then, you know, each one plays less, and it's that same conversation. Like, Ullmark was so unbelievable in every category that despite his lower games played, he was the slam dunk. I don't know if that'll be the case this year.
With the Hart Trophy race, so I've been thinking about it a lot, obviously. It's one of the most difficult fields that I can remember. And I can't believe that I'm probably going to vote against a guy who has 70 goals. Like, and you know, the sorts of 2A results that will probably earn him fringe Selke consideration, and I'm not going to have that guy at the top of my ballot? Like,
It's the penalties. The penalty killing, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That's going to be the strike there, yeah.
Yeah. I struggle with that. Like, that's something that I think is going to be far harder than I thought it would be conceptually even a week ago. Should it be?
It's the most fun Hart Trophy race we've had in a minute. And you know what? You go back a couple years ago, and I think there was a great conversation of Austin Matthews versus Igor Shesterkin, because everyone was so tired of McDavid that they were like, all right, give it a rest. And we narrowed in on those two. And I think that was a great race. But the way the field is so much bigger this year, like, it sucks for guys like Josi and Crosby and Pasternak and Panarin, who are outside that leading conversation because the top four are killing it so much. This is the story I've been working on this week for Thursday. So I am so hyped to really dig in a bit more, but it really depends on how you value goals versus assists. I think if you narrow down the third candidate of McDavid versus Matthews, and it's a great conversation to have. Because I know some of us weigh primary assist differently than secondary assist or overall assist versus gold, but you go through it and even just watching the plays right before we even start like counting micro stats and doing the nerdy things that people like us do, just watching the game, you can see the value of McDavid's assist because it's the playing transition. It's drawing everyone to him that whoever's scoring the goal sometimes just needs to tap in. And obviously that's not something everybody can do and keep up with. So the goal scorers deserve their credit there as well. But the way he dominates play and has come back after playing through injury, it makes it an even more interesting conversation. But if you have a 70 goal score, those are numbers we don't see. And then I know now I'm seeing a lot of conversation about primary points and empty net goals and even strength points, and all of that matters. But you legitimately can't be wrong here, I feel like. You know, you can go
that's right.
Matthews, McDavid, McKinnon, Kucherov. You're not wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, for me, McKinnon is hard to ignore. But, man, the amount of stellar performances, like, I even think Hellebuck should be strongly considered. I even think Quinn Hughes. Like, Quinn Hughes has been on the ice for almost 50% of the Canucks' 5-on-5 goals this year. I mean, that's McKinnon and McDavid impact, but from the point. I think Hughes should be considered. I think Pasternak should be considered. Kucherov, it's ridiculous. The top-end talent in the NHL, it feels like it's never been better.
And it's great, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, obviously, it's going to make obnoxious arguments that we're all going to roll our eyes at, and the discourse is going to be something else. But, like, it makes the game better. You want the stars to start. And I know that sounds like such a basic idea. Like, of course you do. But it legitimately matters, right?
Mm-hmm.
The game is that much more exciting when scoring is up. That's how you draw attention and draw eyes. And when you have someone like Nathan McKinnon, you're a casual fan watching the game and you're seeing him just dominate down the ice the way he does with such force how he skates and gallops. Like, it, you can't not have a good time watching him play, obviously, unless your team's playing him. There, it's so good for the game to have this kind of race for MVP. Like, this is exactly what you want to see. I think it's fun when you have a guy run away with the trophy and everyone could look at him and be like, oh my God, Connor McDavid, he's going to score 200 points. He's on a different level. It is fun too, but I think this is so much better because there's star power across the league in all different ways. You could come up with 10 heart caliber players, and it's tough for them because in a different year, you probably win it. But to be in the conversation with the guys dominating the way that they are, I think is a testament to how, if we're talking about Quinn Hughes in the heart conversation, we should be. To stack him up to someone like Nathan MacKinnon, what he's doing this year, it's a testament to how good Hughes has been for his team.
Yeah, no question. Now, if only the NHL officiated games in a way that allowed that star talent to have the biggest impact on outcomes. Man, that would be cool.
I mean, rest is a miracle. And it's going to be so much worse in the playoffs. But then here's the thing. You get that. I don't know if you caught any of the Leafs Penguins last night.
Mm-hmm.
And Crosby was taking a beating last night. Yeah. There were three straight shifts where he's getting hit, hurt, something, and the whistle kept blowing for him. And you could see the frustration. You go on Twitter for 5 seconds, like, oh, is every time that Sidney Crosby gets touched, we're going to have to blow the whistle. And it's like, you can't have it both ways. Because obviously, I'm sure a lot of it was like Toronto people dominating the conversation. It's like you realize how many you follow every time the Leafs are involved in something. But I mean, part of it is too, like, do you want it called that way? Do you not, like, is there, there's probably a better middle ground than what we saw last night in that game. But when the Stars finally get the whistles, he wasn't really getting any calls. They got the whistles, you know. What do you want?
We don't like that either.
It's going to be a tough one. Yeah.
Well, every other league with the NFL rules protecting quarterbacks and NBA with hand-checking rules has found ways to do it. So I'd love to see the NHL try. Anyway, Shayna, thank you for the discussion. You are an A-plus advanced scout. Let's have you back soon. And be well. Look forward to reading your Norris deep dive at The Athletic shortly.
Thanks for having me.
That was Shayna Goldman. I'm Thomas Drance. You're listening to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. All right. I'm Thomas Drance. You're listening to Canucks Talk. It's our final segment, and we're joined by one of our favorites, Kevin Woodley, very shortly. Of course, Canucks Talk is coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider. It's powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? And of course, if you want to ask Kevin Woodley any goalie questions, check in at 650-650, that's the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you. In Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or on Arbutus in Vancouver. You can also visit them online at DunbarLumber.com. Let's bring in the goalie whisperer. Let's bring in Kevin Woodley. Woody, how are you today?
I'm good. You're flying solo today. Good for you.
I'm flying solo,
not easy to do.
It's a lift, but we're getting through. Thanks to the help we get from our friends like you, good sir. Were you at Canucks practice today?
I was, because I was kind of hoping, you know me and my NHL.com gig, I get paid by the story. So I was kind of hoping we'd have a story today after news that Thatcher Demko would be practicing today, and he did for a good chunk of the practice, but left early, so wasn't available. But yeah, I got a chance to watch him go through drills with Ian Clark for about 15 minutes once we were allowed in until practice started, and watched him during practice, and can tell you that looked good. I have no idea when he's back. There was no information on that from Rick Tocchet. There seems to be a lot of uncertainty. They, you know, sticking with, we have a plan, and not their prerogative, or they don't have any need to let fill us in on that. But, you know, watching the skating, watching the movement, watching the positions that Thatcher put himself into, you know, including one, if we go back to the night he was injured on March 9th, when Hockey Night in Canada sort of ran the footage, and, you know, again, because we haven't talked to him to this point, speculation still, the play he appeared to perhaps have been injured on, you know, actually involves a move called a double seal. The Canucks call it a reverse track. one skate on each post in a butterfly, which, you know, is a move I would say a good half a league can't even do. And he was getting in and out of that, not just with no apparent discomfort or problems, but frankly with explosive pace. So, you know, I remember being here earlier in the season as Joseph Wohl was working back, and an ankle injury, obviously different from what we understand this to be, but that was the last step for him with the Toronto Maple Leafs and Curtis Sanford. And you could see as soon as he got into post entries and the stress that puts on the body, there was hesitation, there was discomfort, and it took him a couple more weeks to get back. I saw none of that hesitation as Thatcher moved in and out of his post. As I said, explosively today without any hitches, a good sign all around, regardless of when ultimately he gets back in the net.
With the fact that he wasn't a full participant throughout practice, does that imply anything to you with your understanding of sort of return protocols that the Canucks, that Ian Clark have in place? Does that imply anything to you about a possible timeline? I mean, could he be as close to a week away at this point, given that he still hasn't put in a full practice?
It may just tell us that he didn't want to talk to us after. I'm kidding.
Half kidding.
Listen, if you're a goalie in this market and you had to put up with me, would you want to talk to the media? Let's be honest. I ask a lot of really
I love talking to you, Woodley, so I'm the wrong guy to ask.
But honestly, you know, I know not full participant, and that's why, you know, he didn't talk today. But the reality, Thomas, is like from the time the gate closed when practice was supposed to start at 11:45, and he'd been out there, you know, we're only allowed in at 11:30. So once we're in, we saw that he was working with Yogi and one of the Sedin twins doing the shooting. As I said, like in some drills that are designed specifically to stress, you know, some of what for a lot of goalies is beyond end range of motion and movement. And he looked great doing it. I can't tell you how he feels because we didn't talk to him, but he looked great doing it. And but once actual practice starts and, you know, the bench closes around 11:45, from then until 12:12, he was a participant and a full participant in practice. He had his own net. Seelovs and DeSmith were sharing one. And when he left, it was only 5 minutes later that, you know, Coach bangs the sticks and they all gathered around at center ice. So yes, practice continued by beyond that, as it always does, as guys work on one-on-one skills play. And, you know, I can tell you, you know, probably 25 minutes later, Casey DeSmith had not come into the room, was out there with Ian Clark, I imagine, working on his craft. But that's, you know, that's 27 of 32 minutes of the formal practice, you know, before Tocchet left. That's a pretty good chunk. So, I didn't see much that limits them. And again, until they tell us, we don't know and we're speculating, and I hate to do that, but what I saw looked really good, looked really promising, and looked like a guy who, you know, again, they're going to be careful, and we don't know why or if there's something that's they're waiting on. I can't tell you, but in terms of him moving around the crease, he looked great. And so what that means for when, he didn't look like a guy who had anything restricting him at this point. With the obvious caveat is we haven't been able to ask how he feels.
What did you make of Artur Seelov's bouncing back after that Jack Eichel goal handcuffed him? And what did you make of that goal as well?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it's funny we talked about it today. Like, I can tell you this, there's no Jack Eichel shooting on you in the American Hockey League. There's no Jack Eichel shooting on you, frankly, when you play the Anaheim Ducks or the Arizona Coyotes. Like, they both have great players, but like Eichel's at a, you know, he's in that superstar level, and did a great job of sort of putting the defenseman in a spot where he was able to use him as a screen, and Artur's just got caught in transition, and we talked about it today, like literally one spot between the glove and the pant where a puck can squeak through and it finds it, and that's, you know, that's the power of a Jack Eichel shooting. You know, as a goalie, maybe if your hands are pressed just a hair forward, you're able to cut that off and seal it against your pants. It found a hole. I just liked the way he reacted from that point on. Wasn't tested a ton after that, right? Like at the end of the night, you know, Vegas ends up with six high danger chances, and you know that ends up going. And here's the other thing: like I think a lot of people off the rush from that distance, the way it looks, they're going to say that's a low percentage goal. It's actually a mid because of the way Eichel did two things. One, crossed the middle of the ice before he shot, off the rush and use the defenseman as a screen. So, and actually, as I look, I'm like, wow, that's actually nothing like this on the radio, eh? That was actually went down as a high danger chance in the first period.
Really?
It was the power play goal through a screen that ended up being the mid percentage goal.
Mm.
So, you know, again, it goes to show you what we expect, and that's not subjective. That's like objective analytics. So it just goes to show you sometimes what we think of a goal doesn't necessarily add up math-wise. So I just like how he responded to it. You know, there's lessons being learned throughout here. And I think this goes back to Arthur's last year, right? Like, I think we forget the first start wasn't great for him last year against the Rangers. It wasn't terrible by any stretch, but he got better the more he played throughout that 5-game run at the end of last year. And that, to me, as much as you can dial in on certain technical aspects and maybe a tendency at times to be a little antsy and aggressive and chase pucks a little bit, to me, it's more the mental test at this level. And there's a lot of them. Like, this team isn't giving up a ton of shots right now, but there's still moments when they're high danger chances, like the cross ice to Hanifin on the back door in the second period last night at a crucial moment that he makes a good push, a good seal, and puts himself in position to get hit. You know, a lot of goalies maybe aren't getting there as quickly and efficiently as he did. I just like the way sort of he seems to respond and build from one game to the next. And that's, I think if you're a Canucks fan, that's promising, not just for the now, but for the moving future.
How do you square what we've seen from him at the NHL level with the fact that he struggled at times as the number one in Abbotsford this year? Like, how do you contextualize Seelov's season in full? Granted that there's still some road to run here, whether it's in the Calder Cup playoffs or maybe backing up Demko come playoff time. How do you square sort of what this year has represented for his development and what it means going forward?
I do wonder when you come off, you know, like I said, the success he had in the 5 games last year, the success he had at the World Championships, you sort of get into the season and it's him and Spencer Martin, and then all of a sudden there's a veteran in place and you're not part of the picture. Like, in your mind, I wonder sometimes if you can, you know, project yourself into the National Hockey League. And we've seen a lot of guys that when that doesn't happen and they end up back in the American League, it can be an adjustment to go back. You know, I've had this conversation with the goalie coach in Calgary with Dustin Wolf. You know, and there's a guy who's, you know, back-to-back goalie of the year in the American League. But the first time he went back down after that first season of winning that award, it was not easy. It was not an easy transition. And so sometimes it's the focus. I know, you know, in sort of talking to people in the goalie department here and around Arturs this year, you know, there again has been that tendency to just not let the game come to him, which sounds so cliched and simple. And, you know, right up to Jake Ottinger, who we think of as an established star, like that's what's changed for Jake in the last 2 weeks after running an 896 through mid-March and everybody going, what the hell's wrong with this? Like, this isn't Jake Ottinger. So if it can happen to a guy like that, it can certainly happen to a guy with as limited as experience as Arturs, but just to want to try to do too much, to just not be able to sit back and let it come. Really easy to say, really hard to do as a goaltender. And I actually had a column on it last week. It wasn't directed at him or Casey, but they both provided voices for it. Talked to Devin Dubnyk, I've talked to Henrik Lundqvist about it in the past. That relaxed intensity, finding that line, because it's not like you can go sit back there in a rocking chair and that's almost what you need to do. You have to battle for every puck, but if you're battling too hard, too prematurely, like, it's not just trying too hard is bad, like, mindset-wise as a goalie, like, it literally manifests itself in things that limit you physically. Like, trying too hard creates tension in muscles, and tension is the enemy of goaltending. You tend to dig into your edges a little too low and wide, which limits your mobility as a goaltender. So finding that line between battle mode and relaxed, is it takes some goaltenders years, and I think that's something that Arthur struggled with at times in the minor leagues this year. And if things don't start well, what's your tendency? Your human nature, you're competitive. I got to fix this. I got to work harder. I got to try harder. You can work harder in practice, but try harder in games just doesn't work. And so I think there's been a little bit of that. And that's why, you know, I thought there were even signs at times in the Anaheim game in the third period of it a little bit. And so to sort of step back from that and be able to sort of reel it back in and get back to what you're trying to achieve and not chase it too much is a real, you know, it's a real compliment to sort of the mental makeup of this young man.
with DeSmith's struggles since the Demko injury, I mean, in your mind, in the event that something happened in the playoffs and the Canucks needed to start from a backup goaltender, which, you know, happens a lot, right? Both of the last two Stanley Cup winners used two goalies. Penguins used two goalies when they went back-to-back in the playoffs, on and on. Do you think the Canucks would agonize about Seelovs versus DeSmith?
You know, it's kind of a fair question. It might even depend on your opponent. Like, it literally could depend on what you're giving up, what type of chances. Like, if you want to dig into, I mean, on the surface level, you know, there's the experience of DeSmith. Talkett said just half an hour ago, like, he doesn't think the moment's too big for Arturs, and that's good. I do think that if you started with DeSmith and he, you know, you could make a very fair argument that he deserves it for everything he's done for this organization this year, but deserves doesn't, you know, honestly play a role for long in pro sports. And so the leash might be short. It's hard to say whether they'd agonize, but certainly I don't think they'd stress if they decided to go that way as an option. Like, I don't think they'd be worried about Arturs. And again, hey, like, playoffs are a different beast and the pressures are different and the atmosphere is different and the highs and lows can be very different as well. And so how he reacts to that, we won't know till he's in it. But I would point to the World Championships. I would point to, you know, beating the Americans and Casey DeSmith in the other net at the World Championships and the pressure that comes with that situation for a team that I don't think had medaled before he did that and an MVP performance. Hell, I'd point to last night because it felt like the air was coming out of that team at that point after those first two goals. And yes, for the most part, it was the team itself battling back and the power play getting a couple of goals and frankly not giving up a ton after that. But behind that was a goaltender who couldn't afford really another mistake. Even if the Hanifin won because of the screen, if maybe he could have handled the screen a little differently, that's fine. But on a couple of two-on-ones late, he's out, he's square, he's aggressive, but he's made a read the pass isn't getting through, and he takes them and controls those shots. The backdoor in Hanifin in the second period when the game, you know, was still in doubt, like, he made some really big saves. Under the pressure, what we all talked about was felt like a playoff game, right? So I don't know that, you know, I don't know if I'm answering it very well in terms of whether they'd agonize. I think if the question is, would Arturs be a good option? Could he be a good option? Absolutely, I think so. Because that's how you build a depth chart. And it's very hard to maintain that depth chart at the NHL level for long because it's constantly evolving. But I think you ask any goalie coach around the league and he tell you his perfect depth chart is a workhorse number one, a backup who can give me a good quality start every 2 weeks, and then a number three up and coming in the minors who may be not ready for every day in the NHL, and we don't want him playing every 2 weeks, but if we need him for 2 months, he might have more upside. And I don't know that we're quite there yet. I don't know that it's easy to say that they definitively have that, but there are signs they might have that here.
I guess so. Just to put you on the spot and, like, force a more direct answer, do you think they'd have the conversation?
Would they have the conversation?
Need a playoff start from a backup. Is it a conversation for Clark, Tockett, Rutherford, and company?
I would imagine that it would be, yes. I imagine it would be a conversation. I don't know that it's necessarily a slam dunk,
right?
Based on how the last month has gone. Listen, like Casey DeSmith has given them a lot of really great minutes and done everything you would ask for a backup. But since the injury and since the workload has picked up, the adjusted save percentage and it was in a good spot all year, but since then it ranks 51st out of 66 qualifying goalies over that period in terms of, you know, minimum number of shots. So, you know, we've seen it sort of take a step back, and that's just what the numbers say. And I think there's some games there that aren't all on him. But I think we still got the next couple of weeks here. Well, I guess however many games are left, and assuming Demko gets at least two of them, there's still a couple more starts here that could sway that either way.
Do you think it means anything for how the Canucks approach the backup position next year? I mean, is Seelovs at the stage where the club should consider him as next year's full-time backup, or does he still need to play 40, 45 games as opposed to, you know, 15 to 20 while wearing a ball cap most of the time?
You know, this is a tough one because...
Yeah, it's complicated.
You feel like he's ready, right? Like, he's showing you signs right now that he's ready for this opportunity. We know how hard he works, and we know that that's a great fit with Ian Clarke as your goalie coach. And yet, I don't know who most famously said this, like, but if you have time, use it. And so I've always sort of argued that, you know, unless you have an opportunity, unless you're 100% sure they're ready and you have an opportunity that there's still enough minutes, there is value in using waiver exemption for as long as you can when it comes to goaltenders. And whether that looks like, you know, another Casey DeSmith type in the back, or even DeSmith himself in the backup role here next year, so Arturs can go down and continue to play, or somebody maybe with a little less pedigree at the NHL level but does have some NHL experience, signed to more of a number three role on a one-way ticket that you think will get through, you know, waivers early in a preseason, and Arturs is your guy up here, and you use the fact, and I've credited the team multiple times for you know, finally having the AHL team nearby. I mean, Ian Clarke did it with Jonas Korpisalo in Columbus. The Nashville Predators did it with UC Saros early in his career. Use the fact you can ship them down. You know, like if you've got a weekend and Abbotsford's got, you know, 2 and 3, and you know that Thatcher's your starting goalie on Saturday night, you bring up the guy, that number three guy with NHL experience, to sit on the bench Saturday night, and you send a guy like Silas down to the minor leagues to get his two games in over the weekend. But he's still a part of the team during the week, practice on a day-to-day basis, seeing shots. Like, Arturs hadn't really seen much this year in Jack Eichel last night. Seeing that on a more regular basis in practice, the pace and the intensity. There's a way to sort of couch it and have the best of both worlds. It could depend even, Thomas, on the salary cap, right? Like, and,
yes,
and how much you need to save on that position, because there aren't a lot of big names available on the market, but as we see the need for two and even three goaltenders around the league, you know, could a Laurent Brossoit set the market? I mean, the first time he went to Vegas from Winnipeg after a season like the one he's having right now, I think he was 2.5 or 2.75. Like, could we see the backups push into the $2 million range? And if so, you know, maybe that makes up your mind for you.
I say yes, by the way. Like, right now, I think the median backup price is going to be over $2 million once the dust settles on this relatively thin free agent class of goaltenders.
Yeah, no, and I mean, we're seeing the importance of having, like, more than one option just all around the league. Like, as much as we're blessed in Vancouver to have a Thatcher Demko, you know, like Winnipeg with Hellebuck, and like the list of teams that has that, and even look at the Islanders.
Yeah.
Like, Ilya Sorokin is supposed to be in that class, and they are playing for their playoff lives right now with Semyon Varlamov in net ahead of a healthy Ilya Sorokin, right? Like, you know, if you need to ride a guy too hard, you usually run into problems. There's very few that can do it. Even in that second tier, like Charlie Lindgren is another great example, has been exceptional for Washington, got them back into this playoff race. But they hit a stage where they felt like they had to play him every night ahead of Darcy Kemper, and eventually you start to get into diminishing returns, and now they're at the point where it's like, I can see the diminishing returns in his game. Not terrible, but you can see the slippage.
Yep.
But they can't really afford to take him out. So, you know, you got to have options, and that could drive up the price on those guys that have, you know, maybe not a huge pedigree, but at least enough NHL experience that teams feel safe. You know, if they need them for 25, fine. If they need them for 45, maybe this guy can do that too.
Woody, thanks for your time. We appreciate it. Seelovs Talk here on Canucks Talk. You're listening to Sportsnet 650.